You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many ways to be able to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, what if you could reach your personal goals while helping create a sustainable, food-secure world? Well, our guest today is not only just doing that, but he can teach us how to do it too. Chet Sisk is a life coach as well as a leadership development specialist to the World Assembly of Youth. Now, a former advertising executive and journalist, Chet's job now is to develop new forms of leadership with youth that incorporate connectiveness, sustainability, compassion, insight, vision, personal empowerment, and of course, love. And he has worked around the world with emerging leaders in South Africa, the Netherlands, Malaysia, France, the Sudan, Hungary, Canada, Morocco, and many more than that. Now, one of the things that drew me to Chet was a powerful quote that I read about him. The best single indicator of great leadership is the new The best single indicator of great leadership in the new world is measured by our ability to empower the most vulnerable in our society. I absolutely love that. That nails it for me. Now, Chet is also an author. He is the author of several books. Think This, Not That, 7 Steps to Success, I Learned from Homeless People, Because You Can, and his newest book, Welcome to a Cooler World. We've changed. Here's proof. And here's what to do now. Chet, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. It is a pleasure and an honor to be here, and I send you love and greetings from the Mile High City, Denver, Colorado.
I appreciate that. I have had a chance to go to your website. I've had a chance to look at some of your books, and I am so thrilled at what it is that you're doing. And it's one of those things. It's like I don't even know where to start because you are literally making a difference everywhere you go. So I think to start, though, let's start with the newest book. So Welcome to a Cooler World. Tell us a little bit about what that, what is that about?
Yeah. Well, the book goes back actually to, I would say, a year and a half ago. I remember running into several of my friends who were saying, the world's going to end on December 21st, 2012. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, really? And I had heard, discussions like that for years. But then all of a sudden I started hearing my close associates start to, parrot some of that conversation. So I said, okay, let's go find out. So then I went and I started reading what the Mayans were saying about that particular date. And they never, ever said that the world would end. They just said that we would move from one cycle to the next. So the world ending stuff is just, I always say it's a paranoid linear mainstream media that just doesn't know how to, it has no appreciation for the esoteric. So it has to kind of dumb down, if you will, the conversation to, like it did. So, and I say that as a former television reporter, talk show host, blah, blah, so it's not sour grapes. I'm just speaking from some experience. So I said that, okay, if the Mayans say that there's going to be a change in the cycle, and the world is going to change in some context, then, and they were saying that there was an indication, at least kind of an agreement, that we would be moving into a better world. Things would change for the better. So I'm sitting there thinking, this is sounding pretty good. But if that's true, there should be some evidence of that, right?
Uh-huh.
Kind of like when is spring? March 22nd, right?
Uh-huh.
That's the official date of spring. But for those of us who've lived long enough, we know that spring starts to show up early, right?
Right.
Expand longer days, grass gets greener, warmer temperatures, blah, blah, blah. So my thinking was, so maybe the Mayans counted this date as a kind of like, okay, this is the date that it officially begins, but there should be some indication leading up to that time. In other words, the change should be zoom, not boom. It's
right.
Not like one day, all of a sudden, boom, it's spring. It's more like this is the official day, but we should see evidence that there's something that's happening going forward. So I spent a year compiling this book. It didn't start off as a book. It was just me and my curiosity trying to figure out whether or not the world was getting better. And sure enough, I didn't have to be a Fulbright scholar in order to figure out that the world was getting better. And I was a little stunned by it, and so I just doubled down and started really digging into all of those things. So this book is basically a compilation of the data that says these are the things that we used to do. Look at who we are now. The world has actually changed dramatically, and it's moving in a dramatic direction toward the better. It's even in the midst of all the madness that we have to deal with right now, compared to, say, 1918, when 37 million people were killed out of World War I, another 75 to 100 million were killed because of the Spanish flu pandemic, racism, exploitation, colonialism, the robber barons were just flexing their stuff. I mean, we really lived in a horrible place years ago. And so all my book does, this new book says, here are the things that we were. Here are the indications of how we've changed. Here's the data backing that up.
Uh-huh.
And now, here are the things that we can do now to step on the gas. Because it's more than just like being a casual observer to this transition. It really is about what we can do now to step into this, to lean into this whole aspect of becoming this greater world. And that's, I'm just laying out the case for it in this book. So it's pretty good.
No, I think that's beautiful. And I think the key thing is that, you know, it is what can we become? I mean, that
yes.
to me is the whole key. It's beautiful to be able to show people, you know, this is where we were, this is where we are. And I wish like we could get the media to project more about the positive things that we have done in the last, let's just say 100 years or
mm-hmm.
so. You know, if we focused on these are all the great things that have happened, it would probably make it so much easier for us to continue to move forward. But just like
right.
you were saying about the Mayan calendar thing, is that, you know, fear sells. So it made a lot yeah. more sense to just try to scare everybody than mm-hmm. to really go out and say, you know what, this is an opportunity for us to grow.
Right, right. And, you know, I come from J school. I'm a journalism school graduate. And one of the things old Doc Brown, one of my professors, used to say, hey, guess what? This is how it works and pay attention. He said, here's the deal. You know, when we were running the plains of Africa, we were in fear of saber-tooth tigers. You know, we were going to be their lunch that day. So we developed a series of fight or flight tools that we use. Our adrenaline goes way up when we think that there's danger. Our vision actually hones in. It starts to cycle. In other words, the peripheral vision actually starts honing into something real specific. The amount of blood that goes to the brain actually decreases so that it can fuel the reaction, almost the reptilian reaction stuff that's in us. So in the middle of fear, we're not as contemplative. We tend to have an adrenaline rush, which can be very fulfilling, and our vision becomes smaller. So if I want to be a successful talk show host, I'm going to scare the hell out of you because you're going to pay more attention to me. You're going to get an adrenaline rush, And you're going to pay attention. You're just going to be there. You're going to be more present because I am activating the same stuff that a saber-toothed tiger would activate that was developed in this hundreds of thousands of years ago. So that's all I have to do. So if I'm a part of a news organization, am I going to have a show about how great things are and how beautiful the world is and the great things are going to happen? Oh, no. I'm going to tell you that somebody, the president, is trying to take everything you have away. That your neighbor is spying on you. Which, I mean, these things may be happening, but there are 7 billion people in the world.
Uh-huh.
And it's weird how we don't talk about how the other 7 billion, but we talk about the 100,000 or up to maybe a million out of that 7 billion that are doing these terrible things, because that's the stuff we tend to pay attention to because of our fight or flight response. That's why they sell that stuff. That's why they push it. That's why if it bleeds, it leads. And it's unfortunate, but that's part of the old paradigm. That's how it worked.
Well, how do we get them to shift to a new paradigm? I mean, we as the people should be able to harness this, to be able to control it to a point in which, you know, we're just not going to be that reactionary. But
yes.
My question is, how do we do it? How do we get the people to get behind us and head in that direction?
Yes. Let me say this, and some will take issue with me. I don't believe that we should do, we need to work the system. I think that the system is compromised, and I think that the only thing that we can really do, if we're like, oh, how can we get Fox News or, you know, MSNBC to finally tell the truth or whatever, we don't. We create our, and this is what the book indicates, that what really is what's happening is that there are people out there that are creating alternative approaches to what is out there. They're saying, okay, the system is compromised. So either we're going to spend the rest of our days trying to get it to act better, or we're going to develop something that's different or that's away from that. It's not off the grid stuff, but it's more like we can do better than this. And mm-hmm. So they, in a very real way, they move away from the, you know, how bad things are to this is what we can do. So the most important thing, particularly for our young people, which is what I'm doing with the World Assembly of Youth around the world, is that we are basically focusing on how do we teach optimism? How do we make optimism not just a feel-good moment or just people sitting around and singing kumbaya and holding hands? That was part of the old paradigm. They reduced, if you will, optimism and vision and insight and connectedness to a kind of a feel-good thing, because that wasn't part of leadership as it was defined in the old paradigm. But as we're seeing now, the old paradigm form of leadership is unsustainable, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows that it's unsustainable, but it's like they're saying, well, this is all we got. This is the best system we got. No, it's not. It's the one that we assigned ourselves to right now, and the people who are leading the charge that I point out in this next book, Welcome to a Cooler World, recognize that we don't have to settle for what we've been doing in the old paradigm. So we have to teach levels of optimism, particularly to the emerging young adults, and then we have to really immerse ourselves in the idea that we can create something else. And that's hard. That's been hard for us because we, you know, I mean, think about the world. Let's just talk about the United States. In the 1950s, the company, the government was everything. Uh-huh. And even before then, you know, it was all the whole divine right of kings concept that somehow, you know, the guy at the top was divinely there because God placed him there. And we kind of went with what they said because, you know,
it just
seemed like the right thing. Yeah, you better. Or you were a sinner, or you'd be put to death, or something. Mm-hmm. Something would happen to you that would not be a good thing, right? So we're just now getting to the point of recognizing that collaboration, lateral organizations, our voice actually has value and meaning. And that's a big change for us. It's huge, Alan. I can't tell you how much, and it's relatively recent. I mean, really, people are still holding on to that concept. But the idea of all of us being able to participate, not in leaders, but in leadership, is a relatively new concept around the world.
Absolutely.
And a lot of countries really struggle with that transition.
Well, and one good example is if you look at the Middle East.
Exactly.
We have thousands and thousands of years of them essentially living with a status quo situation.
Right.
And I think much of this is the fact that they're seeing that there's different things, that you can't close people off from what's going on in the rest of the world.
Right.
Now with the internet, I mean, they can see that, wait a minute, this isn't the only way. We don't have to give everything to one ruler and then sit back and accept whatever they give us back.
Exactly. Oh, I got to tell you this story. I was in the Sudan about a year ago, Khartoum, and there was a conference there. I was presenting on the new forms of leadership that are emerging in the world. So they knew I was coming. I was the only guy from the States coming. And I was working at the time with the World Assembly of Youth, and we're doing stuff all around the world, which is great. It's a great organization. And they asked me for my speech and all that kind of good stuff, and I gave them my material. And so they prepped their audience. They sent a cooler out to kind of to prep the audience and say, we love Chet, but we don't like what his country is about, and we don't like this, and we don't like that. We don't like his philosophy, but we love him. But little did they know that during the registration process, I was connecting with the students. This is weeks before the conference. I was connecting with the students, and they became my Facebook friends. Guess what? They already knew what I was going to talk about weeks before I even got there. So when the cooler came out, they sat there, and they just kind of looked at him and politely just kind of nodded their heads. But little did the cooler know, because these were old guys who had no concept of social media. Little did they know that we had already made contact with like 80% of the students before the conference began. So they were already in anticipation. They knew what was happening. And I would say that Sudan will be, they will follow the trend of what's happening in that region of the world, because the young people, they know the deal. They know that there are alternatives. They know they don't have to live the way that they do.
Well, it's funny. As you were telling me that, and I was envisioning it as the cooler actually played right into exactly what it was that you were telling them, is that these people are trying to make you believe one thing, and they're trying to keep these things away from you. And then sure enough, he comes up and says, okay, I want to poison the pond first so that you won't buy into any of this. So it's beautiful that you got in touch with them ahead of time. I mean, I think
It was funny. It was the funniest thing, because I kept saying to myself, these guys really don't know the leadership, that is. I said, they really don't know what's going on. They don't know that these students have Facebook accounts, and they're befriending people all over the world. Now, here's the beautiful thing, of course, with social media, is that the more you are connected with other people around the world, the less likely you are to go to war with them, or to hate them, or to think of them and demonize them and say these terrible things. That it's just not realistic when they, when you're liking the stuff that they post, and you're exchanging stuff, and you start to see them. That was the old paradigm. That was the thing that used to work in the old paradigm before social media. Even before social media really emerged, the more people started traveling, and it's truly, I would say, the evolution of humankind, that we start connecting. And once we start connecting, all of that stuff, the information control that the leadership used to roll past us as a way of keeping us in check so that they can empower their position, no longer works. And that's happening, again, like you said, the Middle East, you're going to see that continually evolving. Russia, I think, is coming up. There's just a lot of things that are happening. And our job, really, with the World Assembly of Youth, is to empower the 18 to 35-year-olds to implement levels of change. There's a place for going out to the streets and doing these things. But oftentimes, really, change just requires you just to do something. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be the next Dr. Martin Luther King. You can just step into it right where you are, and that's what we find, particularly with 18 to 35-year-old middle managers. These are the guys that rotate the machine. They make the machine go. It's not the leaders. People say, get rid of this guy, and you know, the change of the regime and then things will change. Nah, not in the least bit. You know, that snake grows another head. The key becomes now to go to the machine directly. And those are the young managers, and you start to, you don't tell them what to do. I'm a firm believer. Don't tell people what to do. Tell them what's possible. And then let them make up their decision. They know what to do. If you open up their possibilities, they will figure it out. It's called, I call it the hope strategy. I think there was a guy, one of the presidential candidates, said something to the effect of hope was not a strategy. On the contrary, once you create a vision of hope, people, and this is my work with the homeless, this is what I found out just working with homeless people for the past 10 years, is that once you create this vision, a vision so big that people are willing to do anything and everything to make that vision possible, they will know how to fill in the gap. But the vision has to be compelling, it has to be powerful, and it has to be bigger than what they know right now. So it's vision is a strategy, and it's a powerful one, and it works. So my job is to make sure that that happens.
Yeah, and I am so glad that you're out there. And I agree, you're getting it out there to the young people. But I want to kind of touch on the older people as well. And it's from the standpoint, again, as an international investigator, mm-hmm. I travel throughout the world. And I go to conferences where we have owners of investigation companies from all over the world. And it's amazing that at a time in which we just had an election recently within our association, and we had a retired brigadier general nominate a person that came from the Indian military, nominate him for third vice president of our association.
Wow!
So it's the situation that, you know, the governments may want them to believe that this is your enemy, but when we get together, that is not the case. And after 9/11, countries, you know, at the same time we're being told that there are people in Middle Eastern countries that are dancing in the streets about how happy they are that this happened.
Right.
And we had a flood of really heartfelt condolences from these owners of investigation companies in these same countries.
Right, exactly.
So these are the business people, these are the people that are successful in these countries. They're not buying into all of this hate and desire for destruction and stuff. They have decided that they want to be part of the world and they want to see what they can do to help. So as an association, we go out and we have special funds that are set aside to help in whatever country is needed at that time, or wherever we're going for a conference or something. There are things that we do.
Wow. So, yeah, it's a strange thing, and that I point out very regularly in this book about the old paradigm and the new paradigm, because it seems there's a very clear distinct move toward collecting or toward connecting all around the world, and there's pushback. I mean, we're seeing it here, you know, through a lot of organizations that, you know, they want to demonize the whole idea, you know, we're right and the rest of the world needs to catch up with us and that kind of thing. And then there are, you know, there's the Taliban and all these other organizations that are around there. All they're really doing is pushing back against an obvious wave. We want to connect. We're desiring to connect. And we're not waiting for the government to lead. In fact, I honestly, we are the government. I mean, I know people want to demonize the government, but the reality is that we are the government. Now, I'll put it this way. I have two cars. If one doesn't work, I'm going to drive the other one. That doesn't mean that I'm going to junk my other car. It needs fixing. But in the meantime, I'm going to drive my other one that seems to be taking me where I want to go. And that's what's happening, like what your organization is doing. And the interesting thing about it is that it's like a hive mind, that it is happening and there's no leader. You know, remember what they were talking about with the Middle East or the Occupy movement when they were saying, where's your leader? Well, see, that's the problem. That leader model, the one that ruled in the old paradigm, it didn't apply now. Now, leadership applies, where there are leaders, where people operate from the aspect of how do we show leadership? How do we become our greatest selves and lead in that direction? But it doesn't take one guy to do any of that stuff. That was our, and I don't even want to call it the failings of the old paradigm. That we were there because that's what we knew. Now we have grown up. And the Mayans were correct when they said that there would be a shift, because the shift has expedited this growth, this change that's happening all around the world. And it's not just us. I mean, sometimes we tend to concentrate here in the States, but, you know, you as an international person, you know how this goes, that, you know, the things that are happening around the world in connectedness, it's not going to show up on CNN or Fox or the evening news. It's just not. That's not their focus. That's not their concentration. Their concentration, maybe someday that might be, but I think what I did in research for this book, I just went to blogs. And I talked to people. I had coffee shop conversations. I traveled the world and had conversations with people. I looked at magazine articles and I started matching them up. But I went beyond just the typical, you know, what are they saying on the evening news? That's the kiss of death, as far as I'm concerned, because really, they're compromised. They really are. And God bless them. But there are some things that they just can't and won't do. And so there are people in the world who recognize that and are stepping into it. And I'm just, all my book does is just chronicle those happenings and the developments. And as we talked about, you and I talked about it initially, what to do now, because we really need to, if there is ever a time for us to step on the gas and to really move forward, it is that now is that time. We are in a very, very crucial time for the champions really to step into that space and to hold the space, because the other guys are going to be pushing back hard. They see the barbarians at the gate. They know what's happening. So they have to push back.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And even though we know that they aren't barbarians that are at the gate, unfortunately, the only thing that they can do is to try to demonize. Yeah. You know, that's the only way that they can get their message out, is to demonize this change, because the change scares them. And mm-hmm. I love what you said in regards to leadership, because yes, I see leadership now as the people that are out there that get the word out mm-hmm. to the people that they can make change. The people that are focused on empowering others rather than trying to take the power for themselves.
Yeah, and that's going to require an element of us to do a reconfiguration of the ego. And I guess I'm of the belief that those people know that already. You know, they know that, okay, what do I want? Do I want to be right, or do I want to be effective? And when you start asking that question, you start realizing that the ego can get in the way of being effective. Empowering others has a distinct, much higher success rate than holding on the power. Like I mentioned earlier, holding on the power for one person because your ego needs that stroking is completely unsustainable, and we all know it. But the whole aspect of, I talk about in the book this emerging world philosophy of Ubuntu, the African philosophy of I am because we are because I am. I like how Desmond Tutu kind of breaks it down, that my success is dependent upon your success completely. And your success is dependent upon mine completely. And when we see that, not as just a nice catchphrase, make people feel good, but as a business philosophy, as a social philosophy, as a spiritual philosophy, how we create foundation from that, then all of a sudden the magic happens. I wrote a book before this one called Think This, Not That. It's time mm-hmm. to update your conventional wisdom. And that book was based around the idea that I started looking around and also seeing that we have embraced conventional wisdom that makes no sense whatsoever, just the wackiest stuff. Not all of it, but a good portion of it, where we started creating policy and laws based around stuff that's not even true. And I kept thinking to myself, well, what are we doing that for? And then if you ask around, people will say, you know, typical answer, well, that's the way we've always done it. And they're so comfortable, it's familiar. And I kept thinking, well, we need to challenge those things. So now, in this new paradigm, we can at least lay down the philosophical foundation for the world to come, and that's where we start to create better laws and policy so that we actually do have a better world based around sound philosophical premises, as opposed to the crazy stuff that's just been flowing out there. I can't tell you some of the goofiest things but again I don't want to say too many terrible things about us from the old paradigm, but I will say that we said some stuff and did some stuff that makes no common sense whatsoever. And in the 20th century, it may have made common sense, like Maslow's pyramid of the hierarchy of needs. Everybody says, well, yeah, that's, people are still using that even today. But the reality is that, you know, even Maslow came back before he died in the early 60s and said, yeah, you know, my stuff is not fully vetted. So yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Well, and it's a great point, because when people say that, well, you know, that's the way it's done, or that's the way it you know, it's always been done or something like that, it doesn't make it right. I mean, they're still doing it that way. Okay, but that doesn't make it right today.
So, right.
And for those of you out there that are listening, if you want to hear or if you want to read some of the specific things, go to Chet's website. It's www.chetsisk.com. That's chetsisk.com. Now, if you're listening through the computer, open up another screen. You can look at exactly what we're talking about. So we're going to take a break right now. We will be right back. So open up that other screen, take a look, and you're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back with Answers for the Family. We're talking with Chet Sisk. He is an author, educator, and if you've been listening, you know that he's an inspirational leader. Now, Chet, one of the things we were talking about was, you know, the differences that we can make internationally. We are getting an instant message coming over that is from someone that has a question that's a little bit more local.
Okay.
This one reads, my husband lost his job last year when his company did a mass layoff. I have to say that it is a scary time for us, not a time of a cooler world. I am a school teacher trying to keep my family from becoming homeless. This is now how I envisioned life. This is not how I envisioned, I think is what they meant to say, life would be for us and our two children. Struggling to put food on the table and late with our mortgage. Please tell me how you see this changing, as I see nothing in our economy turning around, at least in my city of Los Angeles.
That's a good point. Let me go there. Just for reference sake, I had a thriving advertising agency that was just, it was, I mean, we were closing in on a first $1 million year back in 2000, about the year 2000. 2001 came and 9/11 occurred. Everybody quit advertising. Company went bankrupt in 6 months. Yeah. My wife left me. We lost everything. I had personal guarantees on everything, and I would never recommend that, by the way, going forward. So they took everything. My wife left me. I became homeless. Mm-hmm. I actually was, and for about a year, I think I was mad at everybody, God, George Bush, the Taliban, whoever else I could include into my situation, because I needed some answers, and I kept thinking to myself, You know, I mean, what did I do that was so horrible that I deserved this experience? I just thought that I played by the rules, I did the right things and such. But what did happen after my year, and I will say a year of going through this terrible place of anger and frustration, was that I had to let go of how I perceived life was supposed to unfold for me. And when I did that, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden I run off to an ashram and shave my head and, you know, sell flowers in the streets or anything like that. It just meant that I had an expectation that I thought this is how it should work. And that expectation locked me out. It's like what the Buddhists would say. You know, the Buddhists would say, okay, we can't live a life of attachment. But my teacher was like, it's not about attachment to things. It's an attachment to outcome. Because we all have an idea, like, this is how it's supposed to work based around, quote, the American dream or, you know, something we were told when we were kids and such. And then when it doesn't, we're like, oh, I must be a failure. Something is wrong because I'm not going according to script. But once you let go of outcome, then you at least get to the point of saying, let me entertain stuff I never would entertain or I never thought I would entertain before. So my suggestion, and that's what happened to me, I ended up volunteering at a homeless shelter because of the fact that I was going through it. I just thought that let me recalibrate. It was my grandmother who told me the best thing you could ever do in your moment of crisis is to go do something for somebody else. So I started volunteering. I never would have thought of myself anywhere near a homeless shelter because I used to drive by and say, oh, those poor people just don't work hard enough. Then all of a sudden, there I was. And there I was teaching as a volunteer, and it changed my life. It changed my perspective. It didn't lead me to immediate riches and all that kind of good stuff. But what it did was that it opened my mind and my heart to other possibilities that I would never have imagined. I won't even pretend to understand your pain or the challenge that the young lady is going through right now. I wouldn't even pretend that. But I will say, from a man who had to walk through hell and high water, that the greatest thing that you could ever do is to at least open up yourself to other possibilities that you might not have considered before. There's a chapter in my book where it says there are fewer jobs, but more opportunities for income generation. And that's true because the world now is looking for contractors. They're looking for people to do the work. And yes, no, it's not like the old paradigm where there was the one guy and you work at the company for 30 years and you get the pension and the insurance and all of those things. But there is this growth all around the world where people are just needing the services of other people. They want to do work with other people. It's a kind of a lateral organization. And so it is changing, and that's the thing that's making the difference. And I want to highly suggest that. I hope that offers some kind of vision. And let me also say too that my hope is that you and your husband and the children will get together and create what they call a vision statement. That is, you want to sit down and say, who are we? Where are we going? And what did we do? Who are we now? And where do we want to go? And then it may encompass, you know, writing about what kind of job you want, or it may even talk about what can I do? What skills can I provide in the world? Because now, I mean, I do work with clients anywhere in the world because of the internet. So it's a different kind of world, and the adjustment can be tough because, again, we have expectations. And I suggest expanding that space highly. That's what we tell our students, because a lot of the students who come in, I'm speaking of the students at the homeless shelter, a lot of those students come in and they say, I really don't want to go back to that world because that was the one that kicked me out in the first place. And I'm like, I get that. So let's not go back to it. Let's do something else that's going to require levels of us that we may not have even thought about before, but it's definitely going to require more from us. And that's what this new world is providing, opportunities that we never thought before. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and I hope that they do too. And one of the key words that you said, I think, was lateral. I mean, and I don't know if everybody caught that, but you know, But what Chet just said is lateral. Find something that's lateral. It doesn't have to always be this pyramid type of system. And something that we did as the economy started to take a downward spiral, that we did at our church was we got everybody together and said, look, a lot of us, you know, a lot of us are looking for people that can help in something that maybe we didn't think of. And all of a sudden we had, well, you know what, you know, this person's company needs an accountant and this person's company, you know, this person needs a plumber and this person needs this. And you had people that were now laterally providing services to each other that was now helping all of them. And it wasn't one person saying, I'm going to hire all of you and let's let everything work in that type of paradigm. So, I'm saying I don't know if everybody caught that word lateral. I don't want that to have slipped by everybody because I think that was important.
It is important. And it what I'm discovering more than anything is that it is really, really important for us to reevaluate the way that we're thinking about things. And I don't want to make it a cerebral conversation because when you don't have food on the table and you're struggling to make the mortgage, you don't want it to be that cerebral. You want answers. You want stuff to work. But what we've found out more than anything is that everything begins in what you believe about your way forward. If you believe that it is this difficult place, it has a way of just manifesting that approach. I can't explain it, and I'm not trying to be new agey or anything. I'm just looking at the students, particularly the homeless people that I had to work with over the past 10 years, that it was belief that had a direct dictate over what they saw were possibilities and how they leaned into it. There was this one experiment out of London. Mm-hmm. There was a guy who was he had two groups of people that he was doing this experiment with. One were a group of people who felt that, oh, you know, my world is really difficult and I'm unlucky. And then there was this other group of people who said, you know, I'm, you know, the world is challenging, but, and they used the word challenge as opposed to, you know, difficult. Uh-huh. And they said, yet I still have possibilities and I am lucky. So this guy says, okay, I'm going to have these two groups come to my office. One group came at 10. And before they came, he put like money all around the area. This was the group that's considered itself unlucky. That group, 10 people came. One person out of that 10 saw, I think they had British pounds or whatever it was around that area. Only one person out of the 10 even saw it. So in a sense, that what happened is that they closed down. They couldn't even see something that was right in front of them. The next group, of course, everybody saw. They looked around and they said, oh, look at all this money all over the place. Did you know that there was money out there? I'm not talking about just in plain sight, like right there, but kind of around. Mm-hmm. But the other people couldn't see it because there was something inside of the way that they saw themselves that they couldn't see it. It's like, I don't know about you, but my first vehicle was a Chevy van. I bought it from my dad. I put 60s on that bad boy all over around, white spoke rims, fog lamps. I mean, I had the deal. I painted it purple. It was quite the deal. But after I bought my father's van, all of a sudden I looked around, and it seemed as though everybody went out and got a Chevy van.
That's right.
I'm like, how did that happen? They went out, they knew that I was getting one, and they just copied me.
Yep.
The truth is, those vans were always there, but those things were invisible to me. Invisible to me because my perspective could not see them. They didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing applies for us now, that just a switch of our perspective can help us to see the invisible. The invisible becomes visible. And people think, you know, they say, oh, that's a bunch of hocus pocus. But trust me when I say this, you don't see it unless you look for it. If you don't look for it, you won't see it. So that's why we started saying, okay, if we really want to develop great leaders and great leadership, we need to at least concentrate on what they believe to be true. What is happening? What's working in their heads? What conversation? What's the narrative that they have going on a regular and consistent basis? What do they wake up to? What do they go to bed with every night? That has everything to do with the opportunities or the lack thereof that you might or might not see. It's crucial. In the old paradigm, we used to just kind of poo-poo that kind of stuff and say, oh, that's just all that soft la-di-da. But now we're seeing, without that, we're lost. We need a greater and compelling vision to be able to see beyond the very obvious things that are in front of us. And that creates optimism.
Wow, from your lips. I love it. We have a comment that's coming over via the email, and which is very interesting. It says, I do agree with your philosophy that lifting the less fortunate among us lifts us all. After the hurricane hit our small town in New Jersey, people took time to meet their neighbors and to put together assistance for the homeless, and not just those who became this way because of the storm. I think those who lost their homes for the first time understood what others were going through. As devastating as this event was, the awakening that occurred is still strong in our hearts.
Beautiful. Wow. I got to tell you that, you know, I had the same experience. It wasn't a hurricane. It was just me losing everything and having to start over. My context changed. But I understood the other people, why other people would say that, because they would say, you know, terrible things about homeless people, because honestly, I used to say some of those same things. I regret those things that I've said, but I had to learn the hard way. Mm-hmm. And I take that back. It wasn't the hard way. It was the great way, because it opened up my heart and my vision to things that I probably would have stayed closed down to. It's unfortunate that we have to go through great challenges in order to get that vision. But let me offer another view on this, too.
Please do.
I'm thinking that the most consistent thing about the human experience is that we catch some hell from time to time. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, there's one time there was this thing where people would say, okay, if you will do this, all your troubles would go away and people would be just fine. But that's not realistic. The reality is that all of us catch our own little private hells from period to period. Now, what those things are is determined by us. Either they can be the message in the bottle that finally gets to us and says, listen, there's another way you might want to consider, or they'll just be bumps in the road. And right. What I submit is that those things provide, they are simply the way that the human experience operates when it's trying to get us to go a different direction. Because mm-hmm. when was the last time you can remember somebody who was doing real well and just, you know, millions of dollars, and all of a sudden they say, you know, I want to change my life. I want to just, you know, run off to an ashram and do. When you get to the top of the heap, the first thing that you're trying to do is keep things the way they are.
Yeah.
So you're not at that point where you're open to new possibilities and things, because, you know, you're kind of the beneficiary at the top. But when you're catching hell, the first thing you're thinking about, oh man, I'll never do that again. I'll do this. I'll give to Little Sisters of the Poor. I will do whatever it takes because I need to change my life. So my belief, if we look at the pattern, and this is just common sense philosophy, mm-hmm. that the time when change is most possible is when we're going through stuff. And that means that apparently the human experience has evolved to create these windows of opportunity if we see them as such. If not, they tend to repeat over and over again, and they just become like, you know, we'll sit back and say, oh, I have bad luck. And I would submit otherwise. I would submit that a message is trying to get through, and either we're going to look at it for the possibilities that exist in that, or we're just going to sit back and complain about it.
Right, or the people then that let it devastate them all of a sudden.
Yes.
that devastates them, and they just, you know, they become stagnant and do nothing. I just looked at the clock. We have about a minute and a half, but what I want to two things. One is that please hope that you'll set aside time to come back. I know you said you have another book coming out. I would love, you know, to be able to discuss that further. But to kind of take us out, what's your forecast for us? Will we continue in a positive direction? Let us know.
I got to tell you that the forecast is quite sunny. And there will be things that will happen within our communities, within our hearts, within our souls, within our families, that we probably didn't expect. And I say, go with this flow. It is moving in the right direction, and now is the time, truly, not only just to go with the flow, because we're going downriver with the wind at our back, but also paddle harder, step on the gas. Go for this.
I love it. You just heard it. You heard it from Chet Sisk. And again, if you want to learn more, go to www.chetsisk.com. Again, author, educator, and go on there, check out what he is doing now and see what it is that you too can do to help all of us on this planet. Chet, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure, Alan. Thank you so much for having me. It's my honor truly to be with you.
And mine to have you here. Again, everybody, have a wonderful week. Be with us again next week and be good humans. We're out of here.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.